Hello and welcome to another episode of Press Pause, where I have the absolute pleasure of interviewing creatives in the TTRPG space to talk about what they do and why they do it. Today to chat with me is Alexander Christopher. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Of course. We like to start out by talking about where it all began. So how did you happen upon TTRPGs? When did you start playing?
Oh boy. This is something that I feel like this is a question that always gets asked whenever you join a new group of people. And the answer that I hear usually is like, oh, I got into it, you know, during the pandemic, or it was like 2015. It was when I got into college. I started playing role-playing games in second grade with my father, which was like 2002. You know, that was third edition of D&D. It was still a very obscure game at the time. But it's not that I fell in love with like the game, because that's not what was important to me as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, right? What I fell in love with was the connection I had with my father, and that community is what I still hold to this day. I think if I look at my entire 25 years of playing role-playing games, that's the through line, is community. That's what I care about very deeply. I think that's why I very naturally fell into the responsibility of Game Master sometime around 2010-ish, which I thought I would never do. I was so adamant against it. It was an egregious suggestion. And then it was fine.
And you're like, actually, not too bad.
That's definitely my journey with being a GM. Other than, you know, having overprepared everything, it was so bad, Kenzie. I was so bad when I first started GMing. I don't have it on me, but I still have my first journal somewhere in my library of stuff as a reminder on where I used to be. And also, it's a memory. It's a good memory that I cherish very much, but it is just a full journal I bought from Barnes & Noble. It's a beautiful, like, fake leather, fake fantasy-esque, right?
Yeah.
And it is filled from page to page with scripts. Not story, not character, not scenes. Scripts to read. Because I was so nervous about improv that I needed to give myself structure, and I still do that to this day. I still provide structure for myself, but I literally wrote out scripts. In fact, there's a story. Oh, this is so embarrassing. There is a story that my friend Boone loves to tell. It was my very first session ever as a GM. I began in 3.5, which is an already very complex system to run as a game, and not even including the narrative aspect of it. So I was preparing a lot because I was nervous about the rules as well. And I had prepared a quest, right? And I knew where they were going and what the challenges were going to be. It was some, like, volcano and an elemental they had to destroy in a volcano. Whatever, very classic tropey, right? I love tropes. But I had nothing prepared for the beat before, because I just didn't think about that. I didn't think about the exposition. It wasn't the important part of the story in my mind. And so when my very good friend Boone asked to explore the town, I said, okay, what do you want to do? And he says, oh, I would like to go inside this this inn, this tavern, right? And I said, oh, you can't go in because it's closed. And he says, I would like to open the door. And I'm like, oh, the door is locked. And he says, well, I would like to turn, like, I'd like to pick the lock. I'm like, oh, there's no lock. He's like, I would like to break down the door. I'm like, there's no door. He said, I want to open the window. There's no window. Is there a sky? There's nothing. This is a block. This is a cinder block, and it is a useless feature of the town. You cannot enter it. Do not go here.
That is so extreme.
I was so stressed.
I know.
But like, I was so stressed.
It's just a cinder block building, and it says "in" on it, but it doesn't matter.
Ooh, and, I mean, you know, it's so funny to talk about that because now that is like that is so far from my skills. Now, you know, you learn from your mistakes. That's why I keep those journals. Holy shit, that was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I have always been on the side of over-preparing. So, like, I'll have, like, pages upon pages of stuff. Some are scripts. Like, if I have a monologue I want the big bad guy to give, then I do write that up ahead of time. But I never use half of the stuff I've prepared because the players are not going to ever do anything that I thought they would do.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I... It is. It's really funny to me to talk about this because, oh boy, I used to prep like that for a lot, and it was only about 5 years ago when I started running games for the public that my GMing style changed drastically, and I credit that a little bit to the people who I was working with and for, but I credit mostly to the plethora of role playing games that I was exposed to, and that I had an opportunity to play. I went from having literal journals filled with every single dialogue option to having 3 beats and 2 pages of preparation. I know I want this to be the beginning, this to be the middle, this to be the end. And here are the characters and locations. Here's maybe some important information. If there's a fight, I like to have... Actually, this is not anything unique to me. It's just straight out of the D&D 2024 rulebook. But it's like I like to define the elevation, the hazards, the reasons for movement, defensive positioning, and interesting mixed groups of characters. And I think that's probably the most preparation I do mechanically for any role-playing game now is if there's a fight, I want to prepare that fight. Beyond that,
I have two pages of preparation. Especially in D&D, sometimes fights can like lag or slow the game. And so when you have all that prepared, it does actually just help move the fight along more swiftly.
It does. And I care very deeply about my combat being part of the narrative flow. It's not here's the story, and then pause, here's the board game, and then pause, here's the story. It is all the same thing. And so when you prepare, I mean, those are like 5 or 6 very specific things, but those allow you to give combat interesting storytelling through, and it doesn't have to be through dialogue, it doesn't have to be through plot devices. It can be through combat. You're pushing the themes and tone of what you're doing with environmental storytelling, and with characterization of how people fight. It really adds a level of amazing depth to a fight when you flesh these things out. Like I ran a bunch of games for the celebration of D&D 2024's release last year. And once the Monster Manual, Player's Handbook, and DMG, Dungeon Master's Guide, were released, I took it upon myself to kind of separate everything. I tried very hard to separate my knowledge of other RPGs because I wanted to do a little experiment that if I were to just follow these rules, what would my encounter and in session look like? And it was really cool. I went through the whole chapter about not like campaign building, but adventure building. And it was this very fleshed out story about like a dragon poisoning a swamp inside of an underground temple. And you had to go deal with it. But the dragon, like the fight with the dragon was so much cooler than just dragon in swamp fight them. They were underneath the water. They were pulling people into the water. They were diving between, they were like diving up out of lakes down into other little pockets of underground lakes. It was cool stuff. It was really cool stuff. And I am constantly impressed with how well written that series is.
I do not have any experience with the new version of the DMG and the Player's Handbook, the 2024 version. I did not get into that, but I feel like what I've heard of it is that there was a shift into everything being more story-based rather than being on this round, the monster does this. On this round, the lair does that. Like, I feel like there was a shift into that. Because I feel like as new people have started to play D&D, there's been this kind of resurgence of tabletop games in the last 15 years. That has been where, especially with like with the dawning of like the biggest actual plays and stuff like that, that has been where people have found their style of play to be. And so like shifting the actual writing and vocabulary or context of the game itself more towards how people are playing the game now is what I've been seeing, I think.
And also, if we zoom out, right, because 15 years, you're absolutely correct, that has been the renaissance for role-playing games. We are currently in the renaissance for role-playing games, probably like maybe at the end of it, just having it become status quo moving forward. But if we zoom out and we look at the life of role-playing games, I'm going to talk about D&D because that's the biggest one. It began as a board game. D&D is designed as a board game. It's not a role-playing game. The function and purpose of it was not to tell stories. It was to basically solve a little puzzle and then use your personal puzzle to solve a bigger puzzle in character building and dungeon exploring. And even if you go back and you like read Gary Gygax's quotes about D&D, it's very cold. I mean, second edition D&D, Gary Gygax talks about being a game about taxes. The purpose of D&D is to pay your taxes because they could not think of another reason that people would go risk their lives instead of picking up a day job. It's because their taxes were so incredibly high that they had to go kill monsters and collect treasure to pay their taxes. And which is, I mean, that's a whole story that we're not going to unpack right now. But it went from a game about paying taxes to being about story with the it's commonly attributed to the release of Ravenloft, which are you're familiar with Ravenloft? I'm guessing. Okay, yeah. So. If you read like the foreword in the Curse of Strahd, which is Ravenloft reprinted, the designers kind of talk about why they made Ravenloft, and the story goes they were playing with their friends, exploring dungeons, going from room to room. They're fighting trolls and orcs, harpies, whatever, random monsters to collect their loot and pay their taxes, and then they came across a crypt, and inside the crypt rose a vampire, and he had, you know, X health and Y abilities, and he stood there so confused about why this vampire was a random monster in this dungeon. It felt like a disservice to him, to the importance of their history, and he went home that night with his wife and said, we have to do something different. And so they sat down, they wrote the beautiful, well, the very well structured world of Barovia, which has had its problems, and those have been addressed, those have been solved, but the point is that it was the first real bit of world building and care that was put into something published for a mass audience. And it's a very compelling story, you know, it's very sword and sorcery, it's Dracula, it's gives you a reason to care about why you're doing what you're doing. And that was the birth of storytelling in our role-playing games. And I think that with the birth of the computer and the internet, information has become so widespread, and the availability to tell your stories and listen to other people's stories has become an important part of our culture, which is why role-playing games have become not just like board games, but vehicles to explore and express your story. I mean, I think I'm gonna say this, and I don't think it's a secret to anybody. So many players use D&D to safely explore parts of themselves or their lives that are difficult to talk about or difficult to admit or hard to vocalize. So they have a chance to have catharsis about it, and they come out better because of it.
Usually, the hope is that that is what happens.
Yes.
We're kind of talking a lot about storytelling here, and you know, D&D, as you stated, wasn't originally built for that. So what type of TTRPGs do you think outside of D&D are kind of your preference to play? Are there any specific game systems out there? Do you choose games because they're narrative focused? Do you choose games for specific mechanics?
So I own a lot of role-playing games, and I've played almost all of them. I think I was just talking to my friend last night, going over, like, what have I played on my shelf and what haven't I? And there's, like, two role-playing games on my shelf I have not played, which is kind of wild, because they're all very different systems. They're all lots of different rules, you know, they differ drastically. And I think I do have a preference towards games that share storytelling with the character players and the narrator, the GM at the table. I personally really care about having the GM not know everything. I want the players to do so much of the storytelling. But as far as a specific game, that's hard. I truly believe every RPG is a little piece of art, and they're all here to tell a specific story. It is not, I want to play this game because this game looks fun. It is, I want to tell this story, and this game does that the best. The same way you would choose to carry an umbrella with you, or a raincoat. Or you would choose to go to the beach with swim trunks, or with sunning tan lotion. They're two different things. I'm either at the beach to swim, or I'm at the beach to tan. And I need to give myself the right tools for that.
I was going to ask about, like, favorite tropes and stuff that when it comes to media that you might bring into play as recurring themes, but it sounds like you're more focused on playing the game as the designer wrote it to be played, rather than like having a story and trying to find a game that fits what you're trying to do.
Yeah, you know, the two things kind of now for me, the two things happen simultaneously. When I see an RPG, I also see the story it wants to tell. And those two things can veer a little bit. They don't have to be so on the nose. I mean, that's why we have so many different versions of Powered by the Apocalypse, you know? But I would never pick up, for example, Glitter Hearts, which is a game about magical persona transformation. It's very Sailor Moon. I would never pick that up and try to run it as a slice of life game. Because it's not. It deals very deeply with themes of transformation, of heroic responsibility, of identity, of perceived identity and actual identity. And it doesn't have to be like magical persona. It can be a little bit different. I think I call it my Saturday morning cartoon game. I could play that game as Sailor Moon or as Yu-Gi-Oh! I could play it as Pokemon or as Digimon. It just cares about having having two very different sides of yourself, one that everyone sees and one that nobody sees, or one that everyone sees and knows as you, and one that everyone sees and does not know as you. Yes, I think, just to kind of bring it back to your question, I do think you're correct. I don't pick a game with I rarely pick a game with a story in mind. I usually see a game and the story comes to me because the game tells me what it wants to be. It's like I don't know if it's a quote or just a practice for sculpture, but my friends who are artists often talk about, like, when you begin sculpting something, you don't really go in with, like, a perfect plan of what it's going to be. The media kind of tells you what it's going to be, you know, when the clay shapes itself, basically. And that's how I feel about role-playing games. RPGs tell me what they want to be.
You have a vast knowledge of RPGs, but I feel like you also, I don't feel like I know, that you also have your foot in the door in the actual play space as well, just adjacent here to TTRPGs. I want to talk about Roles Untold.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Roles Untold is an indie actual play based in New York City. How did that all get started for you guys?
Do you know the story?
I don't think so. I think that I am asking this for me.
Okay.
I'm being nosy.
It's another little embarrassing story for me. Okay, so I was working at the 20-sided store in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I was responsible for a lot of community engagement for the role-playing scene. I ran miniature painting from time to time. I did retail. I did a lot. I was a real big face at the store. And one day a customer comes in, and I'm talking to him like I do to everybody. I'm talking about all the cool things, the RPGs. I'm upselling him on miniatures. I'm trying to get him to spend more money in a very honest way. You know, also, in a, this is something you
you're
will
a clerk,
enjoy.
You're a salesperson at the store. That's your job.
And we get to talking about mini painting because he's buying a bunch of minis. And I said, oh, we have mini painting tonight if you want to come play, because he's telling me about this 3D printed Tarrasque that his friend made for him. Giant, like, I mean, it's massive. It's like the size of a microwave. And I said, you should go get it, or you should bring it and to mini painting. He said, oh, well, I live kind of far away. And I said, well, let's pull up Google Maps. Let's see how long it would take you to get home, get back here. And it was like 15 minutes after the event started. So I did it. I sold him that ticket. I upsold him on that ticket. And he went home and he came back and he's painting his thing. I'm running the class. And at the end of it, and he was telling me about how he wanted to begin an actual play. It was like an interest, but he didn't really have too much for it. And I said, oh, you know, that's cool. That's cool. Let's talk about it. And so I didn't teach that mini painting class. I left, came back to work. Some amount of time later, I am running the mini painting class. Because the owner is in another country. And I go through the whole night, and at the end of it, this man, who I had forgotten existed, comes up to me and says, hey, I'm running this RPG at a bar I work at. Would you maybe want to come do that game with me? And I go to myself, oh my god, I have no interest in going on a date with this guy. And so, very politely, I say, oh, no, it's okay. You know, I'm going to be busy. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. I work that day. Oh, I don't have enough money to do it. You know, I haven't got paid yet. I'm coming up with a lot of excuses. And this man is insistent that I should go. And he's not going to leave me alone. And so I went to grab a piece of paper to write something down. I don't remember what it was, but I hand him a pen and paper, and he goes, oh, if you're going to give me your phone number, I already have it. And I stand there. I think I actually probably had this very disgruntled, confused, like, scowl on my face that mm-hmm. clearly said, no, you don't. I didn't give you my number. You don't have that. And I think I even said that, like, oh, you don't have my number. And he says, no, I do. You gave it to me. You gave it to me a couple weeks ago. I'm like, why did I give him my number? And he goes, yeah, because we were talking about that actual play. And my heart stopped. And my brain started running so fast. And I realized, holy shit, this isn't a date, it's an audition. And I immediately began backpedaling. I immediately started saying, oh my god, well, maybe I can get that day off. Maybe I can make room in my schedule. You know, oh, I'll be tired, but like, it's okay. I'll have coffee. Like, oh, I'll try to find the money. He goes, well, if it's a money thing, I'll pay for you. I'm like, oh, no, it's okay. I'll figure it out. And so the day comes, I go to the bar. He is already paid for it. And I go and play, and it was great. That man's name is Tanner Neef. That's where I met Olivia Ross, who's also on our team. And that's my introduction to Rules Untold.
Nice.
A comedy of errors exclusively made by me.
Tanner's just like, why is this guy being so weird? I want to play a game.
And Tanner's an oblivious...
Oh, yeah. I love him.
He's an oblivious man. He had no idea this was happening. Yeah, so that's how I got into it. And for the first year, well, before that, we spent a lot of time just figuring out what the heck this was going to be. It was new territory for us. All of us are actors and performers. Some of us have had production experience. Some of us have had stage managing experience, directing experience. But none of us had done an actual play at that point. And so a lot of the pre-production and the first year was stumbling through itself. You know, there's a lot of really great stuff from it, but there's also a lot of really great lessons that we learned from it. The biggest of which was not to live stream. Live streaming is cool, but it's not something that we could maintain. And so we made a switch. It is. It's difficult, you know, especially the expectation for live streaming is campaign with like 40 episodes. The expectation for filmed actual play is 5, 10, 15, maybe 20 episodes, which is easier because it's less time, but it's more difficult because there's more involved. There's more pre-production. There's more scheduling for filming. There's more post-production, and there's more marketing that goes about it. But all of those things I don't see as like this is a problem because we have to do this. They're opportunities to be better. And that's something that we really leaned into when we restructured our company. We really restructured our company into having more proper roles, and the whole thing feels like a film set now, which is fantastic. Everyone on the team is an excellent member. They're so good at what they do. And I am our director, which I didn't really imagine the role of a director. So much of what a GM does is the role of a director. And I didn't really realize that until I actually came and did Roseville Beach with you, and it like clicked. That was that 2 month process. Something snapped in a good way, like a puzzle in my brain, and it all just became very clear. I could see everything, and it blended the art of RPGs and the art of storytelling for media together seamlessly. And that is not to say like I am always our GM, because that's not true. But I am there to guide talent, right? Talent is character players and GM. Everyone is working together like a film set to tell a full story in a very intentional way. And that's my role in production is ensuring that the vision is fully met and is told in a way where the choices are big and dramatic and the strongest choices they can be. And a question I get a lot is like, well, what does a rehearsal look like for an actual play? Because it's not, there's no script to rehearse, you know, there's no like book work to be done. It's not like an improv show where you can just do a bunch of exercises. And so much of rehearsal, in my observation, in my experience, is exploring choices for character dynamic and relation to themes and tone, the story you want to tell. The same way I talk about how an RPG tells me what story it wants to be, that's the first level, and then the next layer is it tells the characters who they want to be, and it tells them the choices they want to make, and it tells them the stories they want to say with their characters. For example, right now we're on production for our first short form season. We have.
So you finished season one, correct?
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Let me back up. Let's finish okay, that thought, good. And then we'll talk about this, because I'll lead into a full tangent.
No, good. I just wanted to clarify for like the audience. You have like the completed work that you have with
yes. Been told. Yes, thank you. yeah, so we did the first season of The Fate of Galvera as a live stream format. And we have begun production on a bunch of different series, whether they are single season or they're seasons that could continue is something that we'll explore. I think if the opportunity arises for a story to have more to tell, if there is a great interest in exploring characters or worlds beyond the first sort of iteration of them, then we will offer that, right? A big part of the production philosophy that I've had is we want to tell the stories we want to tell, but I want to also tell the stories I want to be heard. And so I'm doing a lot of listening to myself and listening to the audience, which is very exciting. We haven't released any of those new projects. So once they become released, it'll be interesting to see how they are received. We have been in production for a few things. We had filmed a special, so a single session episode, a one shot called Scythehaven, which actually we released a little zine for on Free RPG Day earlier this year. And that one's like an afterlife Suicide Squad. You die and you're pulled from your afterlife into the Scythehaven Squadron. You go on these dangerous, deadly missions. And if you pay off all of your cosmic debt, you are returned to life with like a wish that you can be granted. So that one has a release schedule of later, later once it's edited and released.
Later.
And then, we've begun production on our first, like, longer other series from the structure we've had, which is great. I'm very excited to jump into, other stories. You know, I really care about stories being focused and ending, and I'm excited to have a chance to direct a 5-episode story arc, because it's tight. A single session, ironically, feels easier than 5, because you hit everything in that single session. You hit your beginning, middle, end. You get your catharsis. But when you do 5, you can't add so much to tell that you don't have resolution, you don't have closure, and you can't add so little to tell that there's no investment in the characters and why we are doing what we're doing. And so we've been doing really good work. We'll start filming later this month. And that one's really fun. I can tell you a little bit about it. It's called Sliced, and it follows a group of chefs who are part of an intergalactic cooking show, the most important in the world, in the galaxy. Whoever wins Sliced goes on to have their own restaurant opened up in the capital city of the galaxy. They become like huge, famous celebrity chefs. And there's a lot of themes of like industry versus nature. And without spoiling too much, the show is sliced, but it is not about the competition.
Okay.
We're going to get to see like the ugly side of the, we're going to get to see the ugly side of,
you're going to see Chopped when the cameras are turned off.
100%.
Yeah. Another thing about Roles Untold, though, is that it is an in-person AP, which I call it an in-person studio AP because that's what it is. But when we're in New York, there's actually only one company one AP company that I've talked to who actually has like a professional studio. So when I'm talking about studio for the audience here, I'm talking about like in somebody's bedroom or like in a kitchen somewhere in an apartment, just so we're all aware of what I'm talking about. But what is it like kind of having that in-person place to run these games from?
You know, I didn't expect, on some level I did, but I think I just underestimated how much of a work culture would be developed. There are five of us who own the company. That is pretty unusual. Most actual plays are run by one, two, maybe three people. And
RPG.
Exactly. And it's so much responsibility on those few people that getting to divide it amongst five people is both a blessing because we can lift work off ourselves and just recognize, like, we can recognize there's so much passion, right? So there's a lot of voices. But I would trade every day having too many ideas for having less work to personally do. And also work that is stronger for someone else to do can be passed off to them. So that's the biggest part of like how Roles Untold is structured that I think is unique. But as far as like an in-person studio, in addition to that work culture that's been developed, it's interesting. You know, every week for a year, we filmed in the studio. And I don't think if we had done that, it would not feel the way it does. Because even though our studio is one of our producer's apartments, it feels like my place of work. I go there on a weekly, like biweekly, sometimes weekly basis to do work, to rehearse, to have production meetings, to look at assets for maps and miniatures, and to develop world building, to talk about everything and anything we need to do. And we're lucky enough that our studio is in a separate room from any other room. So it's not in a living room, it's not in a kitchen, it's not in a bedroom. It is a third room in the apartment, which is dedicated for, it's dedicated towards doing the work. And it's evolved throughout its time. I think it's always felt very professional. Even when we began, we put a lot of work into our rigging for our mics to drop down from the ceiling, for a little bit of lighting to begin, and we had like a projector in the beginning. But after we moved from live streaming, we did a major overhaul of the set, of the studio. We had a custom table built. It's absolutely massive. It houses a giant TV screen in the center of it. It has inlaid dice rollers in it for every player that can like lift up and you can roll your dice. It's foam lined and it's hollow. It makes this beautiful, loud rolling sound on camera, on mics, every time you roll dice in it. And it takes up like 75% of the studio space. But it doesn't look that way on camera. And I credit so much of that to the genius work of our executive producer and our showrunner. We have like shower curtains, I think, that are blue, and they have like geometric designs on them in silver. And they line our walls, and they add, and it's done in a way so that every camera is angled. No one is on a flat surface, everyone's on a corner. And it looks so big on camera. It looks It is professional. It doesn't look professional. It is a pro studio in an apartment. And every time we have a new production, we get a little bit better. Sometimes, you know, that's about putting money in to get better equipment, which we did a lot of in between the old format and the new format. But a lot of times it's just adjusting. You know, I think we, our showrunner talked about, like, this frame isn't right, so we have to move the cameras, and this is how we have to move them. And we only get to learn those things because we have the luxury of being able to produce so much content because we have five people working on it. I mean, I think it's kind of a crazy statement, but we have planned out productions for until 2030. And I don't think there's a single year that doesn't have three productions in it. A special, so a single episode, a short form, so five episodes, and like a long form, about 10 episodes.
It's a lot of work, but it pays off in the end. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Hero Forge. There is no better gift for a gamer than a custom miniature of their beloved TTRPG character. So this holiday season, take the guesswork out of gift giving and treat your players to a digital gift card to Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. You can make minis in a variety of materials, including premium unpainted plastic and color standees, and they even offer downloadable model files so you can 3D print your unique designs at home. And for the dice lovers in your party, never fear, Hero Forge has you covered with their custom dice, which lets you put your hero inside the very D20 that will help lead you to glory. Visit heroforge.com to send your players a digital gift card and let them build the heroes of their dreams.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
We mentioned that you had done a bit of playing with us on CRPG. And so I want to talk a little bit about Moonlight, seeing as you GM'd what will be our fourth season using that game. I don't necessarily want to talk about the game because I don't want to give any spoilers away, but I kind of want to talk about your experience with Moonlight on Roseville Beach, the TTRPG, and like how you first came across that and like what kind of drew you to that game.
Yeah. So, again, while I was working at the 20-sided store, I was saturated in role-playing games. I was saturated in actual plays and game designers. It was like you are soaking... I have to back up and explain what I'm describing because it won't make any sense. Where I grew up, there was a little restaurant called Word of Mouth, and they made a creme brulee French toast. And the way they made this creme brulee French toast was by... And it was like toast this big. It was bread this big, so it was very fluffy. Yeah, it's so big, and it was very fluffy. It was very like porous, lots of air in it. You know, porous, lots of air in it. And they would make the creme brulee French toast by soaking it in custard, so that the custard would be absorbed into the bread and then cooked, and then they would put like a whole layer of sugar and caramelize it on top. But it's that process of taking in all the custard into like your body, into your bloodstream, into your mind, that happened at the store for role-playing games. Instead of toast, it was me, and instead of custard, it was role-playing games. And one of these experiences was Moonlight on Roseville Beach. It was pretty early on. Richard Ruan, who wrote the game, is a very good friend of the owners of the store. and they were there pretty often, whether that was to drop off that game and other games they've written for us to sell, or they were running games or just saying hi. I met Richard a lot, and it always interested me because the front of the book, there's a tagline that says, like, how can you enjoy your gaycation when there's a mystery to solve? And it has just beautiful, very stylized artwork of, like, the 70s, of, like, Americana 70s. And it grabbed my attention. That the cover told me what the story was going to be. It was so appetizing to look at. And then I hadn't touched it for a long time. I mean, I had a meeting with you, and I pitched it because I was very aware of it, but I didn't actually read the game until a couple months before we began playing. And that was a pleasure to get to read. There's a lot of mechanics that cross over in RPGs. And that's okay, because there has to be some amount of structure to games in order for them to feel approachable and understandable. Sometimes a game comes out and does something so incredibly different, and it's very successful, and there's no question about it, and everyone lines up to it. But most of the time, it's okay to borrow. It's okay to see things that work and use those things. And so, like, a dice pool situation where you pick up D6s based on certain situation, certain questions, and you roll them to see if you succeed is not anything very revolutionary, but what is very revolutionary is how success was determined. So many role-playing games that I've played, almost all of them, the GM, the sort of narrator, tells you, the character player, what success and failure looks like. You roll a thing, you fail, this is the consequence. You want to do this, you succeed, here's the reward. But in Moonlight on Roseville Beach, success and failure is determined by the players. And I don't think I realized how impactful and important that would be until about 3-4 episodes into our season, when the choices that were being made by the actors were so different from my expectations. They used their success and failure. And to be very clear, when you roll on Roseville Beach, you have several things you're checking for. You're checking for to see your goal, to see if you succeed at all, to see if you get hurt, to see if you get scared, to see if you get clues, to see if your character's traumas come to play. There's a lot to see if magic doesn't explode in your face. There's a lot of things you're rolling for, and each one of those has a success, fail, and partial success that's possible. And what was fascinating is watching players choose to succeed in areas and fail in others in a way that invited them to tell the fiction of the story. I talk a lot about how my style of GMing, I don't want to say my style of GMing is so unique and I'm so special, because I don't think that's what it is, but I do feel that it's very different from most other GMs. A lot of times that role is I'm telling you everything, and I don't like that. I don't want to do that. I want to be surprised as well, right? I'm a player at the table, and I try to set up the structure so that my players can tell me the story, and then I can respond back, and they can respond back, and it's a back and forth of improv with each other, and where we go and what happens is not something I know. For example, I rarely like to describe things for my players, unless it is something that is very important to... No, sorry, let me correct that. I try to only describe things if they are significant to the themes and tone I want to tell, if it's environmental storytelling that I want to express world building through, Or if it is something that I am really excited to share because I have such a clear vision of it. Otherwise, if it's something about the characters, if it's something about, if it's something they notice in a situation, if it's something that is important for them to tell, I do my very best to give those players agency to take essentially the role of GM, of narrator, to tell the story. That's why I use the term narrator instead of GM, because it's not about... I don't view the role of GM as being the same as the narrator. The GM is responsible for the events that will happen. The narrator is responsible for moving the story. And that can be the GM, that can be the players. That can be anyone at the table. And it should be everyone at the table. So to bring it back to Roosevelt Beach, the fact that the mechanics supported that responsibility of narrator so well and so intentionally was incredibly rewarding, incredibly satisfying. I mean, we played like what, maybe 20 episodes, like 20 sessions with all of our rehearsals and stuff. And yeah. And I feel so, I feel so satisfied with Roosevelt Beach. Like, I don't need to pick it up again to play. I do want to, but the game, it's like watching a really good movie, right? The game was so incredible, and the story was so engaging that I could leave it and not pick it up again for years and still be in love with it.
I actually really agree with that sentiment because it truly was a fantastic story that we all came together to tell. And the game was so fun and like just kind of added to what we were doing that I almost don't want to pick it up again because I'm like, well, I've done it. Like I've done it. I don't, what else am I supposed to do? We've done it.
Exactly. I think if I were to run Roosevelt Beach, I would have to do it outside of the setting. Because we played it in the setting provided by Richard. Because it's a fantastic, incredible setting. It's very relevant to our world today. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about the specifics, but we touched on such important themes in that story that I don't need to explore those themes. I have serious catharsis about what happened. And if I were to pick up Roosevelt Beach again, I would want to tell a queer story in a different space, whether that's a different time period, or it's a different situation, or it's a different universe, or it's not about queer people, but it's about othered people. Mm-hmm. I want to play the game again, but I don't need to play Roosevelt Beach.
I got that. Speaking of themes in this game, I asked Richard this because we had a conversation just a couple weeks back about Moonlight, and I wanted to get your ideas on it and pose it to you as well. What do you think the biggest difference is between games that are intrinsically queer versus games that a group of queer people can make gay but don't necessarily have it built into the system?
It's intentionality. It's what I talked about with a game telling you what it wants to be. You can have a blank slate and you can turn anything. I'm gonna use the art analogy because I think that was very successful. You could have a blank piece of paper and you can draw anything on that blank piece of paper. You can be given crayons or markers or pencils. You can be given watercolors, ink, and you can draw anything. You can draw the most beautiful mountain, but it will never be a sculpture made from that mountain. It will never be the rock. You know, it will be an image of the rock. And that has its place. That's okay. That's not a bad way to enjoy life. It's not bad to enjoy a painting of... it's not bad to enjoy a painting or a photograph of a location, but it is a different experience to visit that location. They are for two, again, they're two different purposes. And having the opportunity to visit that location is almost a luxury, you know? If I'm going to run with sort of how I've been talking about it, you have to pay for the tickets. You have to pay for booking. You have to pay for food. You have to pay for travel. You have to pay to get to that location and to get back from it and to pay for the flight back home. You have to take off work. You know, it's a lot of preparation. It's a lot of work to be done. And when you are in that location, you don't think about the work. You just get to experience the beauty and the realness of it all, you know, the very honest place you are in. And when you go back home, you are left with a peace. How do I want to say this? When you go back home after visiting that location, you will always have a piece of it with you. You know, that's going to be a memory that you keep forever. And it's not the same as looking at a photograph of that location. And so in a role-playing game scenario for this, the designer has done all the work. They're the ones who have put in the labor. They have done the research. They have made all the intention. They have worked extraordinarily hard, not only to make a game designed to tell queer stories, but to put it on the market and get it into your hands. That's the hardest part of it. Once it's in your hands, that's getting to be there. That's getting the opportunity to have this really beautiful experience. And the designers who help you get there, I can only imagine that's one of the most rewarding experiences, is giving you this very honest arrival into a queer story that is not a depiction of a queer story. That is a queer story. I mean, in Roseville Beach, a lot of that work is done through world building, sure. It's done through the village, and we have descriptions of the locations. But it's beyond that. It's about the choices. You look at the playbooks, and all of the playbooks push queer stories. It's about people discovering their identity and not believing it. It's about people being able to transform themselves into someone more appropriate. It's about people exploring new worlds. It's about people being casted as dangerous because of who they are. Those are queer stories in a way that you won't get from playing a rogue or a paladin or a sorcerer. You can tell those stories with those classes, but it is not designed to tell those stories.
I really liked that analogy, and I think that's a beautiful kind of end note about Roseville Beach. But since we're coming to the end here, I've got kind of a fun one to close us out.
Okay.
Can you tell me one of your favorite moments at a table? It can be sad, it can be happy, it can be joyous, it can be traumatic, just kind of something that you remember, you look back on fondly.
Can I do two?
Sure.
Okay. I'm choosing two because one was something that I felt very successful in doing because of my agency. And one is that I felt I provided agency to my players, and it was so successful. And you'll connect to the latter one because we did it. The first one, I was playing Curse of Strahd, and my players, which were all my colleagues, very good friends. We were on a contract in Alaska, literally living in a cabin in the woods. We played through a 6-month contract. We played the entirety of Curse of Strahd. They did everything. They did not skip a single thing. And I began that game in a way that I had never done, where I said, okay, we're doing this differently. I'm telling you what the story is going to be. I'm telling you what we're going to do. Here is the end of the story. This is where we're going. Make a character that tells that. And in Curse of Strahd, that was make a character that tells classic gothic horror. I want you to think about your favorite story and make a character from it. Make a character from Dracula, from Frankenstein, from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Be a monster or a victim of a monster. And all of my players locked in. They locked in, and we had the debutante turned vampire because she fell in love with the wrong person. We had the thief cursed by a witch, and now she's slowly turning into a witch herself. A witch in this case is like very classic, like Wicked Witch imagery. We had werewolf abandoned at birth, who did not know they were a werewolf, and is only coming to terms with that now. We had a later addition, which was a pirate sailed into the wrong dock, and now is cursed with this thing they cannot undo. And so these stories already pushed the narrative in a way that was very successful for me as the GM. However, it also informed them on how to tell the story. And I did not do this consciously at the time, but that was my first instance of providing agency to my players to be the narrator. And it formed in a way where two of my characters, the vampire and the witch, had become incredibly antagonistic towards each other. In a way that could be a problem at a table, emotionally for the players, but it was a very safe environment. You know, they took long amounts of time afterward to decompress and to, I think literally after one session, they hugged each other for like 5 minutes straight. It was a very intense game because the themes are very intense. And about almost at the end of the campaign, there's a moment where you go atop a mountain in Barovia, and it's filled with all of this very dark magic. And they had already been fighting each other in party dynamics, and they had antagonized each other. Our vampire had held our witch's familiar hostage, and that sort of blew up into a moment of to an extreme moment in this evil temple. So much that they ran out onto the mountain and began initiating their own combat with each other. They initiated their own combat and were running the rounds themselves. I was not a character in this. I played the environmental storytelling until, out of nowhere, because he can turn invisible, whatever, the bad guy shows up, stabs our vampire, who's the primary antagonist, who is the player vampire who is acting as antagonist in the situation, through the chest, throws her off a mountain. And it was just this most delicious, satisfying, this most satiating pain I think I've ever inflicted on my players, that I felt so safe to do because we had successfully cultivated a space to do that. I'm getting goosebumps talking about this. I look back so fondly, actually just talking about this with my friend, I look back so fondly on that moment of interrupting the scene and forcing them back together so well. It was just such a successful moment for me. And it changed everything. I mean, that was the climax. Like, sure, Strahd existed. That was the climax of the story. And then the second one was more recent. I wrote a lot of modules because I write so much for actual plays and other things, and I can't write for my home games. So we were playing through Wild Beyond the Witchlight, which I love. It's a Feywild adventure. It's one of my absolute favorites. Everyone should play it. If you want tips and tricks, I have it down to 9 sessions. It is a 9-session campaign, fully fleshed out. The whole concept is, it's very Alice in Wonderland. It's very Wizard of Oz. You are thrown into another world, and you have to find your way out. You go along basically the Yellow Brick Road. You meet your companions. They help you get to the castle, and you gotta, the Emerald City, and you have to get out. All with more heroic fantasy thrown into it. And 9 sessions is not a lot of time. to build investment. I mean, we're just talking about five episodes being difficult for professional actors. When you're doing a home game and you're not putting as much production behind it, you know, because it's a game you just want to play to enjoy, it's even harder. And I was very comfortable with my current style of jamming. So it was all very intentional for them to tell me their story. They told me the stakes. They told me what was important, and I just helped guide it. Right? I helped make it more important. I helped connect it to things. And so they were already very emotionally connected with these characters. You go to end a campaign, and you're playing them for years. You're playing them for the amount of time. You're emotionally invested. It's very difficult to end that story because you don't want to leave them behind. You've put your real world, we talked about it in the very beginning, you put your real world fears and love and whether intentionally or unintentionally, you do that. And so it's very hard to say goodbye to these characters. Especially when it just happens so abruptly, which is almost every campaign. Every time I've heard someone describe the end of a campaign, it is abrupt, it is sudden, and unsatisfying. And people are left with a feeling of, oh, I really want to play that character again. And I didn't want that. I didn't want that for Wild Beyond the Witchlight. It was too important to me. And so I picked up another RPG called The World Ending Game, which is specifically designed to end a campaign. It lifts you out of the mechanics of whatever game you're playing and lifts the GM out of the GM role. It makes them exclusively a narrator. They are only there to help guide the story, and it asks the players to initiate all of the scenes. There's a certain amount of them in the book, and they're all very intentional, very specific. They end threads. You know, I don't want to say they end like your story, but it gives an end to a thing. For example, one of them is the confession. You have a character who's been keeping a secret the entire game. You never got to tell it. You're really disappointed about that. Amazing. Here's your opportunity for the confession. And that ends that plot point. You have a unrequited love interest in the story, and you it's an NPC, right? And you wanna finish that story. You can do the kiss, or you can do the lie. You know, and so that's either we end up together, or I let you go be with someone better. It gives you a lot of options in what you want to do, and the rule system only lets them be chosen once. Because our stories don't end the same. We should be in different places as characters by the end of our story. We should not, whether that's physically or that's emotionally, we should be in a different place than we began and from each other. That's why it's important. That's why every character is there, is to tell their story, right? Which is unique from everyone else's. And so I followed it very by the book. I had everyone fill out a little questionnaire, which hits hard. The questions are like, some of them are fun, like, oh, when you return to this game as a person, what will you think about the most? What did you enjoy? Does your character deserve to be happy? It's intense questions. And you build a collective playlist together. You play it while you're playing. Some of the rule systems, every scene has its own rules. Some of them directly use them. Like, we didn't do this when we played it. But there's a karaoke track where you put on a song and you sing as your character singing that song. And I think that's one of the most powerful ones.
I think that would have been a little out of place in our game. It would have
been out of place, 100%.
Yeah, but I see the vision.
For the purposes of a home game, again, there's a difference between production of a product and playing a game for enjoyment. And so we go through all of this, and there's a lot of crying from my players. There's a lot of catharsis. People are legitimately upset in a way that's satisfying. You know, I mean, the way we ended those character stories was very intense. One person was looking for their boyfriend who got lost. They thought left them years ago, but it turns out they got lost in the Feywild and they never made it back home. And in the story, we never got to meet them. We got lots of clues about them, but we never got to meet them. And so they concluded through a series of scenes, they found their boyfriend, they reconnected, they got married. One of them was a fae, the other was human, so they died out, and the person lived hundreds of years. And their story ended with the death scene, where they, it was really sad. They were on a bed, and everyone that they loved was around them, and they saw, like, the lights of the carnival from, like, the first session outside the window, and they walked out into the carnival and were greeted by all the people they love. And that's how their character died. And that was the end of their story. And it was really sad, and there was a lot of crying from it because of this very overwhelming amount of closure. And the other character went on a whole story about rescuing the last of the Jabberwocks and providing, I mean, that was a little silly. They rescued the rest of the Jabberwocks. They opened up a daycare for all of the lost children in the Feywild. They made friends with one of the primary antagonists, which is this kooky old hag, and they took care of them. And then that story ended with them passing on responsibility to the next generation. So they were done with their career as an adventurer, but the next generation was just beginning. And by the end of it, my two players said something to me, which will always stick with me, which was, "Alex, that was so fun, and I never need to play that character again."
That had to feel good.
That, oh my God. I felt like the most successful GM in the world. There was there's nothing that I want more than for someone to complete their story in a way that brings them so much satisfaction and joy. And we're currently in our next home game, and we're just in it now.
Yeah.
But because those two players saw the end, it just informs everything else differently. I think there will never be a moment that's like that first one, because that first one was so special.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us expected it to be what it was. And it is going to become a norm for my campaigns, for my home, and honestly for actual plays that I do as well. But I'm grateful to have the knowledge going into it, because it lets, and I've already seen it, it lets my players and myself make bigger, bolder, more intense choices, because we know that they will be resolved. There's never going to be something that's left open and unsatisfied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed the use of that little system when we played too.
What was your experience with that?
Well, I think, honestly, I have never... Okay, saying never, that's a bit much. The 88% of my experience as a player in a TTRPG has been for an actual play. And so therefore I don't necessarily feel like that was strange for me. I think that if I instituted that in my home game for my players, they would be taken aback. They would be like, what is this new fantastic thing that I'm being given or shown? But I feel like for me, so much of actual play is narrative driven, and you are trying to find that closure to wrap up a story, that it's almost, I think it provided a better avenue for that than just like being like, and your stories, guys, end your stories. But I feel like, but I,
so panicked, so panicked. You gotta end your stories, end your stories. You have to end them now. End them.
Yeah.
End your stories.
But I feel like I always, in the games that I run on in actual plays, or the games I play in actual plays, there's always like that epilogue moment. So yeah, but I think this was a better avenue to do that with entirely. So
yeah, I mean, it's just more intentional, that's all it is. It says, here is the concept of saying everyone gets one paragraph to end their story, and says that but more.
Yeah,
that but for everything. And once you're done, Once you feel satisfied and you're done, you're done. You don't you don't say anymore because your story's done. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, you know? It's hard because we love our characters. It's hard because we don't want to say goodbye.
I think what's so interesting too is, as kind of like a last note here about Moonlight, which everybody will get to experience and you'll see it for yourself, at least in my perspective of it and the character that I played, I love that character. I loved playing that character, holds a super special place in my heart, but there is nothing more I can do with that character, and trying to play her again is a disservice to her and the story we told.
Yeah. I agree with all of my heart. The character that you played, Kenzie, went through such a journey. They began in a very different place than they ended. And it, without talking about the story of their journey, just more about like what every character kind of goes through, right? Which is about the struggles that you face and how you overcome them. Again, going back to the mechanics of the game, you, as the player, when you were past the narrative focus, chose to make such strong choices with your success and failure that pushed that story in a way that I could have never done for you. And it was very magical to see you go through this journey, and then at the end getting the reward of going through all of that, all of those struggles, it was so satisfying to see. As the narrator, as the GM of the story, I was so invested in your character. There's in a lot of indie RPGs, especially powered by the apocalypse, there is a GM agenda. There's a player agenda, which is usually have a strong character, like engage with the world, and then there's a GM agenda, which usually has like support the players and know the rules or whatever.
Add drama,
exactly. But yeah. One of them that's in every single one is be the player's and character's biggest fan. That was how I felt running Roseville Beach for Queer RPG. Every day I arrived, it was not let me, I mean, on some level it was let me tell the story, but it was more of, it's like when you sit down for live TV. You know, we don't really have this experience anymore because everything comes out streamed, but it's like I waited a week for the next installment of this TV show, and I have to know what happens because I'm on the edge of my seat. I'm so invested in these characters, and I need to know what happens next. Which I think is why the closure was so important for me, because I couldn't wait for the next thing. You know,
you can't let it go either. You have to. Yeah, yeah. Well, you heard it here, folks. Season 4 is gonna pop off. Well, thank you, Alex, for chatting with me today. As our audience has heard, they can look out for the new Rose and Told shows coming out. They can catch you GMing. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Scythehaven Squadron will be the next show that we release. Keep an eye out. If you want to join our Discord, you can go to our Instagram, Rose Untold, or to our YouTube. And there will be a link to that Discord where you can chat with myself and with other cast members for Roles Untold. You can hang out with our community. We have sections to talk about, like episode discussion, but we also have spots for sharing your art and your creative passions, and my favorite channel, the Dice and Design, which is all about showing off your dice. We had somebody show off their Arby's dice, so show off your craziest dice you own. And in addition, that channel also talks about role-playing games, where we get to share role-playing games we've been writing, or ones that we love, or if you just want to pick my brain, you can always do that. Say, Alex, I have this story, please tell me what RPG wants to tell that story, and I'll get you there.
Great. So everyone go over there, join the Discord, and then you can also catch Alex and his wonderful GMing skills on season 4 of QueerPG. Thank you all for listening, and until next time.